This is PCJ Radio International.
Radio Berlin International.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Pyongyang of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and welcome to another edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Now, there are some of you right now that are listening to this program not off AM, not off FM, not off shortwave, not off the internet. You're listening to us via satellite, either on Sky Digital or on WRN, or the World Radio Network. Media Network Plus airs three times on the weekend on WRN. Some of you have asked us, how did WRN start? What is its history? Because you're not really too familiar with the network. So I thought that today we would put the attention on the World Radio Network. Now, there was a time a number of years ago when international broadcasters started looking at satellite. They would put their programs on a satellite feed. So one minute you can hear German, Russian, followed by French, English, and then maybe some other languages. So everything was just one after the other. The World Radio Network is different. The World Radio Network has different channels for different languages. So if we take, let's say, Radio France International. If you want to hear French programming from Radio France International, you can tune to the French network of WRN. If it's English, you tune to the English network. So it's a lot easier to find content. Our guest today is one of the founders of the World Radio Network, Jeff Cohen. I met up with him recently on one of his visits to Taiwan, and we talked about the history of WRN and also about radio in general. We got into some very interesting topics.
Well, we're 21 years old now. We started at the beginning of 1992, and we had the idea that the sort of platforms available to broadcasters would be changing. And why didn't we create networks that had programs in a single language from a variety of broadcasters? At that time, the broadcasters had the idea, let's move on to new platforms like satellite, but we'll put all of our different languages one after the other. And we said, well, look, it's, you know, you're not going to get an audience who's just there for your half hour in English or your half hour in French. Why don't we start channels that are all in a single language, and then you can, you know, you'll be able to, you know, get an audience. So we did that. It actually wasn't the thing that we first did, because we were all the three of us who started what was the World Radio Network were working at the BBC. And we had these ideas, but it didn't look like it was going to be feasible. We didn't have any money or any other resources to do it. But we were very lucky. We managed to get a contract with Vatican Radio at the beginning of 92. They desperately needed some satellite distribution in Europe, and we arranged a channel for them. And on the basis of the income, we were able to get offices, and we were able to launch the English channel in September to Europe, and then by the beginning of 93, we were broadcasting to North America.
What was the reaction from other international broadcasters? Because I can just picture them at a meeting. You're sitting there and you're saying, look, we want to bring together you, put them all together in one channel. Was there any, did anybody say, well, look, I don't want to be on a channel with another broadcaster who is, say, our competitor? Was this issue ever brought up?
Yeah, it was. It was generally the feeling that it might erode their brand. They all believed, well, not some believed that they had a very, very strong brand and that people would come to them for that brand. But others were more pragmatic. They realized that they actually needed to find a way to get audiences. Those that had the smallest amount of programming were the easiest to persuade. The likes of Radio Sweden, Vatican Radio, they knew that they wouldn't, you know, be able to. The people wouldn't be motivated to come to their programming wouldn't be motivated to come to their frequency for half an hour in English or French or German. So they were very, very keen on the idea, and they really have sustained us.
But what about, like, for example, the big broadcasters in Europe? Let's say like BBC World Service or Deutsche Welle, which is still large by European standards, were they less warm on the idea?
Yes, in general. We had a very difficult relationship at times with our former colleagues at BBC who saw us as a sort of a rival. But the other large broadcasters like RFI, Deutsche Welle, and to some extent Voice of Russia have felt that they really needed to build up their own brand with their own frequencies that would carry as much programming as possible. Mm-hmm. So they haven't been the ones that have been most important to us on the radio networks. But you know, in some of the services, we have had broadcasting from particular broadcasters because we can offer platforms that otherwise would be difficult for them to get onto.
Well, let's talk about the platforms because a lot of people may think that WRN is just satellite. It's not just satellite. You also have the live web streams. You have different streams. Let's say for Asia Pacific, Africa, North America, Europe. But there are, of course, a lot of other stations around the world that will relay WRN on medium wave and FM networks. So would you say you're sort of like a new, not just a platform to listen to these broadcasters, but also a distributor for other broadcasters, let's say, that would not have their programming, let's say, air in New Zealand, but are now having their programming air in New Zealand and maybe the US and some other areas that normally they wouldn't?
Yeah, that's right. We pick up a lot of broadcast relays sort of free. Mm-hmm. because there are stations looking for content. The problem we have is we very often can't guarantee how long it's going to last. Very often if a broadcaster wants a serious relay agreement and it's paying a station to relay its broadcasts, it's got some sort of guarantee that it's always going to be there. Those ones that you kind of refer to, the more casual relays, you know, that come along because the content is required. Yes, they're great, and some of them, you know, can be around, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. You know, we've had some, but they're in different places, you know, not necessarily places that are necessary to strategic interest to our partner stations, they're very useful, and some of the platforms we've been on, cable platforms and whatever, have picked up, you know, good audiences.
Now, since the day that WRN started, we've seen a lot of changes in international broadcasting, especially on shortwave. Some stations have cut back shortwave dramatically. Some have gone off shortwave dramatically. Some stations have just gone into broadcast history. What kind of impact has it had on you, for example, with stations like Radio Canada International gone? Radio Netherlands is still around, but they're not producing audio content anymore. They're producing some video, and they're producing content for overseas distribution by sending scripts. This must have left a lot of gaps in the schedule.
It has. It has very much. Particularly that programming that was of good quality, such as Radio Canada International, Radio Australia has gone, Radio Netherlands, they were very good, and it's a great pity. And there hasn't been anything really that we can get to easily replace it. Mm-hmm. So you know, it's been a matter of having more repeats. So we actually are in the process now of reviewing the networks and reviewing the operation of the networks and seeing if what we can do, because overall, as far as our company is concerned, These networks are a very small part. They were our foundation. Mm-hmm. They're the heritage of the company and what allowed us to move forward. But in radio, we're doing a lot more now, a great deal more. We're arranging relays, bespoke relays for many broadcasters like Voice of Russia and Radio Japan. About 60% of the company's revenue comes from television now. We're doing some fairly mainstream television work.
So what kind of television work is it? Is the television side sort of set up like the radio side by relaying or what?
4 years ago, we bought a TV company in London, it's called TSI Broadcast. And TSI was involved in ingest and playout. And so we are doing a lot of ingest and play out for channels that we send to different parts of the world. We package channels in London for the African market. We have an agreement with a company in New Caledonia, mm-hmm. in the Pacific, and we put together a bouquet of channels for them. In the world of television, you are in a very good position being based in London, because the movie studios much prefer dealing with centres like London. There is a reluctance by a lot of the Hollywood companies to send content, particularly to Africa and Asia, mm-hmm. because of the risk of piracy. So there are certifications that a company can get, which allows it to handle material much more easily. And we have all these necessary certifications at our offices, and so we can freely handle material, which there are restrictions on it going to other parts of the world, which puts London in a good position to do this kind of work of packaging channels together.
Getting back to radio for a moment and satellite radio, The U.S. and Canada have a service called Sirius XM. A few years ago, there was a service called WorldSpace, which is now gone. Do you see that there still is a future for this kind of global international satellite service, where you have a small receiver, a small dish, and you can pick it up from a satellite? Because it seems that WorldSpace just sort of vanished.
Yeah, WorldSpace, in theory, is still going, and we are providing an uplink station for WorldSpace. It carries data and video, mm-hmm. and the WorldSpace took on a great challenge in serving Africa and Asia. Sirius was a much more easy prospect. I wouldn't say Sirius was a much more straightforward commercial prospect of contacting car manufacturers and planning a service based on a few very large retailers, mm-hmm. in the States selling it. WorldSpace had enormous problems because there are no established distribution networks for receivers in the areas they cover. Receivers seem to just get in by all kinds of importers here and there who don't even often very check whether the radios they buy are suitable for the local conditions. They'll buy some radios from the Far East that may be totally unsuitable for the wave bands, may be totally unsuitable for the audience. Mm-hmm. WorldSpace discovered this very late on, that it was in fact very difficult to get their radios in to the areas where they wanted to broadcast. They had very good intentions when they planned services. But it didn't really work out for them. The same technology that WorldSpace developed was sold to XM, mm-hmm. in the States, one of the two companies that merged, right. to form Sirius XM, and it still works for them, and it's just a matter of getting the commercial model right, mm-hmm. and Sirius. I think the prospect is that Sirius will survive. The big change will be the use of IP for radio. Mm-hmm. I've just come back from the Radio Asia conference in Hanoi. Some people there were saying, we should have a radio set that does this. We should have a mobile phone that has a DAB chip in it. I think any discussion of hardware, radio hardware, is very, very, very difficult. You know, it's a completely different matter to say, okay, you can get me on your iPad. You don't have to change the iPad in any way to do that. Changing hardware is very, very, and launching new hardware is very, very, very difficult.
Well, we've seen that with DRM. As much as I love DRM as a technology, from the receiver side, there really hasn't been much on the market, which is probably one of the reasons why a lot of broadcasters don't want to start using it, except for cases like Radio New Zealand International that are using DRM to distribute their content to other FM and medium wave stations in the Pacific, which I think is a great use for it because it's a lot more economical than using satellite. But, you know, in some areas of the world to say, well, you know, DRM is by a DRM receiver, I don't think many people would spend $300, $400 for a DRM receiver. There recently was one that came on the market for about $140, but sound quality-wise was nowhere near a radio that you could buy for a lot less.
Exactly. You know, it's a similar experience with digital radio. In countries where digital radio is simply marketed as better quality than your FM radio, it's failed completely because generally the public is quite happy with FM, and in many cases the public is happy with AM. And
well, here in Taiwan, I remember a few years ago there were about 13 DAB stations on the air. As of today, 2013, there are two left, and they're only staying on till the end of next year because nobody wanted to go spend the $200, $250 to buy a DAB radio when they said my FM radio works fine.
Yeah, the UK has been the big exception as far as DAB is concerned because it's been highly successful in the UK. Yeah, a very, very large proportion of radio sets are DAB sets, which has been due to the big push that the BBC made in marketing it. And if you've got the power of the BBC behind you to market it, and a lot of very good thinking went into creating radio networks exclusively for DAB. Well, they weren't exclusive. In fact, they were available on other platforms. When they first launched, they were on DAB only. And the BBC managed to create a demand for those particular sorts of content, Radio 7 and 6 Music, were very good ways of getting DAB established. But, you know, as far as, you know, the future of radio, it may be that we will move over to an IP based when cars have IP available in the car, a standard.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because here in Taiwan, there's one company that has come out with a radio. In the radio, you put a G3 chip, and you can listen to internet radio in your car. A friend of mine has one of the test models, and it is kind of fun, because if you want to listen to BBC or VOA, you just work like any internet radio. And here in Taiwan, a lot of the local FM and AM stations are trying to legislate the NCC to pass laws against it. But the NCC is saying, yeah, but we have to look forward. We have to look towards new technologies. It's only because a lot of the local stations don't have adequate audio streams yet.
I don't see how you can make a law saying you've got an IP, you know, in your car, if you can have it in your home. So
on your phone.
Yeah. So I don't see that. You know, at this conference in Hanoi, the theme of the conference was radio and social networking, and this is one of the big concerns by radio broadcasters is particularly the young are moving to social networking. They're not spending the time listening to radio. They're not buying radio sets. The number of radio sets bought by the young now, compared with 10, 20, 30 years ago, is tiny.
But this is something that we've seen happen before. I remember a number of years ago when people started downloading music off different websites like Napster and all that, a lot of the big music labels were so late to respond to this market and this demand that when iTunes came along with Apple, that was very successful. And it seems that with audio content or even video content, many broadcasters are just slow to respond.
Yes, but you look at where the word radio is used on the internet. Pandora Radio, you've got Last FM. These are internet websites which use the word radio, because the word radio seems to have some, you know, particular relevance to the audience. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, radio as such is a word, you know, and a concept which means something to people. I think it's a matter of getting people to find you and establish yourself as a brand. There was a report by the European Broadcasting Union on the future of radio and the young. It was a couple of weeks ago it was published, and that report says that the radio stations should build up their brand. Once you've got a really good, strong brand, then you can make sure it's on all the different platforms. Mm-hmm. Including the ones that the young use, and that's the way that you will you will find that they will find you seamlessly, depending no matter which platform you're on. The BBC did a presentation at this conference showing how they can make sure you will move seamlessly from your iPad to your radio set, and It was a very slick presentation, and it looked extremely impressive. I'm not sure to what extent it needs a clever listener to make it work. The EBU's got its faith in Radio DNS, where a station is found by its name, mm-hmm. no matter how it's transmitted, and you just put in the name, and whatever way in which that could be received, whether it's on FM or digital or the internet, the radio will find it by name. That's another way. But my general thinking is that, you know, if you want the young to listen to radio, you've got to employ young people. You've got to know what young people want in terms of programming. But
well, you know, this is something that we've seen in. We were talking about this earlier, how a lot of the big. Not all, but some of the big public international broadcasters are sort of in this world that they're sort of stuck. They've been doing things for maybe 30, 40 years in a certain way. They're not tapping into new markets. They're not changing the way they're doing things, and they're sort of being left behind. And then new startups that come along, like PCJ, we started in 2009, we're sort of going into areas that they're not going into, and then they look at us and they say, well, how are you doing it? And I'm like, well, you've got to change. You've got to do things that are innovative. But it seems that today in a lot of international broadcasters, I'm not going to mention any names, but certain ones that are based in Europe, and I'm not talking about the BBC, talking about certain other ones, they're stuck. They're continuing to do things as they did before, but they're not changing.
International broadcasting has always been like that. In fact, it's one of the characteristics of international broadcasting that it is intentionally conservative. It's like the BBC and Lily Bolero and Radio Newsreel. They stuck to these long after everyone else in the UK completely, you know, moved on, and UK radio was completely different. And you hear the same thing sometimes in some of the, like, the VOA language services, which sound very old-fashioned. Mm-hmm. There's something that is very hard to change, and you do feel that your listeners are used to that, you know, marching tune at the start of your broadcast, and that if you change it, you'll lose those listeners. I think it's just an inherent problem. In one of the things about international broadcasting is that you speak slowly and clearly, and you have these auditory reminders of the way things were, but. It is possible to change. It is possible to change.
I know that at Radio Australia and also the ABC, there was a lot of discussion about playing that jingle that they've been playing on the hour, which they also do still on domestic radio and also on television, which they've been playing for, well, probably over the last 70 years or something. And somebody at Radio Australia told me, he said they actually discussed about removing it. But he said, we haven't found anything that can identify ourselves with that tune. He said, now it's to the point where even though we wanted to change it, he said, we're stuck with it now. We're just stuck with it. But some other stations have things that they're playing at the top of the hour that they should have dumped years ago.
It's exactly it. It's like Lily Bolero in the BBC. You know, it's still played a couple of times a day, just mm-hmm. for old time's sake. Yeah. And the fact that if anyone comes to them and says, you've got rid of Lily Bolero, they say, no, we haven't got rid of it. It's still played. No. once or twice a day. So you can do that. You can just leave it there, so that it hasn't been gotten rid of, but it's not it's not used so much that it's the normal hourly jingle. But people have been saying for I think since the end of the Cold War, international radio is about to go, and it hasn't yet, and we'll see. As long as many of the big broadcasters are there and they hang in, then it's okay. When the BBC stopped their broadcast to North America, the other big broadcasters said, "You're crazy. You've got a very good shortwave audience, and moving to other forms of distribution in the States won't work." But it did work, and the others have generally followed suit. And there's hardly any shortwave broadcasting to North America now as a result of that.
Yeah, I mean, the BBC now has a much bigger in the audience now in the U.S. than they did when they were on shortwave. But it didn't happen overnight. It took some time, but they were able to see that this was the way to go. But, yet other broadcasters that are remaining on shortwave, I wonder how big an audience they still have. When I was working at Radio Havana, Cuba, and I remember how many letters we would get from the U.S., and I still know some people there, and they said, "Oh, yeah, we get maybe a few here and there, but they're always from the same people that want this certain QSL card."
sure, yeah. I mean, there are still some broadcasters that are the old style, appealing to shortwave listeners, high school kids, QSL card collectors. But that's not really what the governments of these countries are paying their broadcasters. Then that's not who the governments of the countries are paying the broadcasters to reach. They want to reach a general audience, and often the audience who are otherwise listening to serious news and current affairs programs. That's the target audience, and that's what the BBC aimed for in North America. Look, the target audience, the people who are readers of Time and Newsweek, and that's really, if you think about who your government is paying you to reach, they're the people.
That was Jeff Cohen from the World Radio Network. To find out more about WRN, you can check out their website, wrn.org. You can also find a link for them at our own website on the front page, www.pcjmedia.com. Now, let's turn our attention to propagation, which we haven't been doing for a little bit because we've been on vacation. Here's our own Dan Hensley.
Here's propagation for the week from August 10th to August 16th, 2013. A 10.7 centimeter flux of 115 steady all week long. An A index of 5 steady all week long, except on August 14th and 15th when we see an A index of 8. The KP index will be 2 all week long, except on August 14th and 15th where we see a KP index of 3. Sunspots 1808 and 1815 are passing out of view, leaving us with 1809, 1810, 13, 14, and 16. No coronal holes are observed at this time. The sun is about to go through a remarkable change, and I'll be talking about that a little at www.pcjmedia.com/RPROP.
And with that propagation forecast from Dan Hensley, we've come to the end of this edition of the program. If you wish to contact us, our email address is very simple. It's mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. So until next time, friends, this is Keith Parent wishing you well, saying 73 and 88 to the ladies.